until now. I think he's still in shock.
That was Abed Salama describing the death of his 5-year-old son, Milad, in a fiery bus crash on the way to a theme park in Jerusalem in 2012. We'll return to our interview with Abed and journalist Nathan Thrall in a minute. Nathan's new book, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy. Back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our conversation with Abed Salama, Palestinian father whose 5-year-old son Milad died in a fiery school bus crash in 2012 in Jerusalem. Journalist Nathan Thrall writes about them in his new book, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy. Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez and I spoke to Abed and Nathan on Wednesday. Nathan Thrall, you write about that dangerous road that Milad would die on. You said everyone knew how quickly Israeli forces would descend on a West Bank road the moment a Palestinian kid started throwing stones at Israeli soldiers or settlers. Yet the soldiers at the checkpoints, the troops at Ramah base, the fire trucks at the settlements nearby, they had all done nothing, letting the bus burn for more than half an hour. If you can talk about this architecture of separation, of apartheid that led to the beginning, so that what we hear in Abed's story is not just an unfortunate bus crash, but so much of which could have been prevented.
Yeah. You know, the particular series of events that unfolded that day were entirely predictable because of the system of segregation and neglect that exists in this area. And there had been people who had warned of it. There had been previous incidents where a tragedy had struck on the other side of this wall, and Israeli services were greatly delayed or even prevented from coming to the area. And so, you know, what the book is showing is not— you know, the passage that you mentioned, those were the words of a man who was screaming at Israeli soldiers that morning after he had almost single-handedly rescued dozens of children. He entered a burning bus repeatedly and pulled kids out of this bus and saved dozens of them. And he was in a state of shock at the end of this, and he was screaming at every person, but particularly at the Israelis, but also the Palestinian emergency service providers at the scene. And he said those words to an Israeli, an Israeli soldier, and he was then summarily beaten for saying what he said. And spent several days in the hospital afterward, but the point is not that the Israelis who were at the checkpoint just next to the accident and didn't come, or at the military base and took just next to the accident and took forever to come. The point isn't that anybody made a deliberate choice to observe a burning bus of kindergartners and do nothing. It's that this entire system was set up to ensure that there would be a very delayed response, that these people live in utter neglect and nobody cares about them.
You also write in the book about the small Scorch backpacks on the road after the accident. If you can talk more about the effect of this system on children, which is the power of this, and let me ask, is really your decision to use this example, this bus crash, the horror of the deaths of the children who died in this fiery crash, to show us what's happening in Palestine and Israel?
Yeah, it was a very deliberate choice to choose an incident that, although horrific, you know, is an incident that takes place, the kind of thing that takes place all over the world, is a terrible car accident or a terrible bus crash, and to show what it means for this seemingly ordinary event to take place in this particular place under this system, because the point is that the system itself, the policies that are in place, the wall that encircles these communities, the desire to demographically engineer Jerusalem so that it would have the maximum number of Jews and the minimum number of Palestinians, and to keep for Israel the maximum amount of land, and the entire route of this wall, the way that it snakes around this community and encircles it and traps it in this ghetto, all of that is dictated by this racist logic. And I didn't want to choose to tell a story that would be exceptionalized and that we would look at some particular act of violence and act about the, you know, perpetrators and the victims and why this event took place on this day. I wanted to show the system that is crushing people every day. And it's brought into sharp relief on the worst day of these people's lives, but they are suffering all of these obstacles and all of this pain from this system, day in and day out.
Nathan, you also describe in your book not only the total disregard and neglect of the Israeli services to the victims of the accident. You also talk about a week later, a left wing television reporter, Israeli television reporter, did a story not so much about the accident itself, but how shocked he was at the reaction of residents, of Israeli residents around the area, the accident.
That's right. Several weeks after the accident, an Israeli journalist, a TV journalist, decided to create a feature about something that had shocked him to his core, which was that many Israelis on the day of the accident, young ones in particular, were writing how happy they were that these children had died. And they were what shocked the journalist, his name is Arik Weiss, what shocked him the most was that people did it without hiding their identity. They felt so comfortable writing racist posts and celebrating the death of innocent five-year-olds without masking their true names, and so he decided to write to create a feature, a TV feature, about these kids, but also who wrote the posts. Some of them, most of them, were kids, I think, and really, what his aim was to, as he says, to show a mirror to his own society and to ask, how did we get to a point where so many young people feel that this is acceptable and aren't afraid even of being caught expressing these views. And they go on, he finds many of the people who posted on that day, and they go on to proudly reiterate the kinds of things that they had written that morning. And, you know, the accident was now just over 10 years ago. And we see that the trends that this reporter was highlighting have only gotten worse. And we see, you know, senior ministers in the Israeli government who are openly racist. And the, you know, when you poll young Israelis, you see they have extremely right-wing views and racist views. So it was a prescient report that he made.
Abed Salama, what has been the response in your community, in your family, to Nathan focusing on this tragedy and the loss of Milad in his book, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama?
In the beginning, my family refused, and especially my wife, she refused to talk about, and until now, she refused to talk about this, the accident, and to talk about Milad, our son, until now. So I took this responsibility alone, and I decided to share our tragedy with Nathan. Maybe for two reasons. The first one is because I loved all the time to talk about my son. When I remember him and I started to speak about him, about what he was doing, about his laughing, his playing, his drawing. So I loved that. Because of this, this is the main reason. The second reason, Nathan told me, I will make from your case, from this accident, I will write an article. In the beginning, he wrote it as an article, not a book. And this will help your community, Palestinian community. This article will help them to show the Americans and the people around the world how is the Israeli government treat you as Palestinians. So when he write the article and I read it and we receive many important comments from around the world. It's a very strong article. He said, "But I want to make it as a book. If you didn't mind, I didn't remind from the beginning. As I told you, I want to spend many times with a person like Nathan talking about my son. When I start to talk about him, I feel that his spirit is behind me, around me. And this time I feel Milad sitting with us here. So I love that. I think, and I hope, the book will make some changes and help us as Palestinians to live our lives as all the people around the world. This is what I hope to. Everyone, every father, every who responsible on his family, he wanted only to live in peace and to grow up his children in peace and safe. And as Palestinians, we miss these things. When you go out from your house, you or your son go out from his house, you didn't expect him to come back safe. Or this is what happened. Because of that, I am happy to share my story with Nathan. I'm here in New York or in America. This is my first time here, so the life here is different. I can see The people here running and playing, working, enjoy. And the kids also. People here taking their dogs around in parks. We miss these things. I want to tell you something. I have a dog, a pit bull dog in my house. I put him in the roof. You know, the pit bull is a strong dog. So I'm afraid to take him down to walk with him the street, because the street is crowded and it's many people. We lived in 130,000 people lived in a small square, like many. As Nathan told you, it's a small place for 103,000 people lived there. I can't walk with my dog in the street. I'm afraid to attack somebody or somebody here or there. When I saw the people here in America walking with their dogs and playing with their kids outside and barking, I feel jealous. I want this life for my children, for my grandchildren also. I hope if anyone from the American government hears me, I hope I. If you want, we want only justice. This is what we want as a Palestinians in the Palestinian Authority.
And Nathan, let me ask you. You first wrote this essay in 2021 that appeared in the New York Review of Books. Headlined, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, One Man's Quest to Find His Son Lays Bare the Reality of Palestinian Life Under Israeli Rule. The article was 50 pages. It in itself was a book. And then you expanded it to the book, the main title the same, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama. What did you learn as you expanded this investigation? And we've turned to you for analysis in Jerusalem of what's happening there. What surprised you most and what affected you most as you went on this journey with Abed?
The book shares just a page or so of text with the article, despite sharing the same title. And the aim of the book is entirely different than the article. The aim of the book is to immerse people viscerally in the lives of Palestinians living on the other side of this wall, and to make them feel and understand what that life is like. And one of the things that struck me more than anything as I was working on it was how much pain there is just beneath the surface in every single Palestinian family. And the book is has Abed's name in the title, but it tells the story of many different characters whose lives collided on this day. And, you know, one of the themes of the book is the degree to which this oppressive system touches the most intimate decisions in people's lives. I tell a story of, you know, of Abed's early romance and his first marriage. And at one point, he has a job that takes him into the center of Jerusalem, and he is afraid of losing his access to the city because of his green colored ID. And he and many other people at that time went and sought out wives who had blue IDs or Israeli citizenship. They were choosing marriage partners in order to keep their freedom of movement, in order to keep their jobs. This is the degree to which this huge oppressive system affects ordinary people. I tell the story of a woman, a doctor named Huda Dahpour, who happened to be on her way to treat Bedouin. She worked for the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, and she was on her way with her medical team to go and treat a group of Bedouin not too far from the site of the accident, and she stumbled on this horrific site. And she pulled over with her team and helped to rescue children from the bus. And I tell part of Huda's story. And, you know, Huda had a boy, a teenage boy, who quite naturally threw stones at occupying forces in his town, outside his school, who were harassing him and other students every day. And at 1:30 in the morning, Israeli jeeps show up and bang on her door and say to Huda, "We're here for your son, Hadi." And she can do absolutely nothing. She stands there with tears running down her face, realizing that the jaws of this state are going to come and snatch her boy and take him away to who knows where. And she spent over 10 days looking just to find what cell he was in, where he was located. And that feeling of utter powerlessness, that it is one that every Palestinian family feels, powerlessness to protect your own children. So you know, the theme for me, what was most striking as I talked to these families, is how much pain there was and how much the state had crept into every single facet of their lives.
Nathan Thrall, what are your thoughts about President Biden meeting Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the UN and then inviting him to the White House?
You know, this is entirely unsurprising. This is what the U.S. has done under every administration. It doesn't matter, you know, Republican or Democrat. They're all supporting the system of oppression. And we as Americans are all complicit in it. And not only are we not doing anything to stop it, we're funding it. We're giving Israel nearly $4 billion in aid every year, in military aid every year. And we're protecting Israel even from UN Security Council resolutions that are condemning settlements that the U.S. is supposedly opposed to. And as Israel spits in the U.S.'s face and won't even restrain the settlement building that it's doing, the U.S. is handing out gifts, political gifts to the most right-wing Israeli government in recent memory. You know, not only is Biden inviting Netanyahu to the White House, they just admitted Israel into a coveted visa waiver program, allowing visa-free travel for Israelis to the United States. The basis of that program, as specified in U.S. law, is reciprocity. The states that are admitted to it must treat all U.S. citizens equally. And Israel is not meeting that requirement. A group of leading senators have said that very clearly in a letter that they wrote to Secretary of State Blinken. And it's undeniable that a Palestinian American who travels from, let's say, college in the United States and comes back to visit is treated entirely differently than an Israeli American coming home to visit from college in the United States. And we had, during the trial period for this visa waiver program, we had Palestinian Americans who couldn't rent cars at the airport. And that's not to mention all of the other restrictions that they faced. You know, Israelis, Americans would come and go and visit a family member wherever they wanted. 40% of the Palestinian population under occupation lives in Gaza. And if you've got a relative in Gaza and you're a Palestinian American, you can't go visit that relative unless it's a first-degree relative. And then you can only do so grandchild, for example, you can't visit. And if you do have a first-degree relative, you can apply for a permit to visit them once per year. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. So the U.S. is deeply, deeply complicit in a system that not only treats people differently based on their ethnicity, religion, or national origin, but treats different categories of American citizens differently. And we've accepted that.
And the significance of these mass protests like Israel's never seen in decades, of hundreds of thousands of Israelis marching in the streets, saying that the Prime Minister, Netanyahu, is violating Israeli democracy by curtailing the independence of the judiciary.
Both sides of the protests over the judicial reform in Israel, what they share in common is this notion that Israeli democracy is at stake. The people pushing for the reform are going to destroy Israeli democracy, and the people opposed to the reform want to preserve Israeli democracy. But the fact is, and it's evident just in the simple example of the characters in this book, we have Jewish characters in this book who live right next door to Abed's community of Anata. They live in a settlement called Anatot, built on Abed's family land in part. And these people travel back and forth. They do not go through passport control when they do it. They vote from their settlements. They're not filing absentee ballots when they vote. They are inside the state of Israel. They are fully a part of the state of Israel in every sense, and they have full rights as Israeli citizens. Living right next to them in the same territory are people like Abed and his entire community who do not have freedom of expression, freedom of movement, freedom of assembly, not to mention voting rights and everything else. And that's millions of people living under the same state without rights based on their ethnicity. I do not know of any definition of democracy that would include such a state within it. So the notion that this judicial reform is about preserving or not preserving Israeli democracy looks ludicrous to anybody who has stepped foot in Anata and Anatot.
Nathan Thrall and Abed Salama. Nathan is the author of the new book out this week, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy. I'll be doing a public interview with them tonight here in Manhattan at 5:30 p.m. at the New York University Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute at 20 Cooper Square. Non-members of the NYU community must pre-register. You can visit democracynow.org for more details. That does it for our show. A happy belated birthday to our director, Becca Staley, and Soldad Aguilar Colon. And condolences to our audio engineer, Miguel Noguera, and our former producer, Ana Noguera, on the death of their brother, José Enrique Neto, an actor, playwright, and puppeteer in Lisbon, Portugal. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Fels, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, and Emily Anderson. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
Standing up against racism is an ongoing battle. How will you help?
I will always begin with bigotry and hatred when I see it.
I will put my passion into action. I will stand against racist words and action and speak out against hate when I see it. Hate has no place in Canada.
I will continue to honor, express, and promote my Indigenous culture.
This message is brought to you by the Canadian Anti-Racism Youth Coalition. Visit caryc.ca for more information about how you can stand up and speak out.
Ha huageste ri CGSF, Nached Poing Aun FM, Crowley Burnaby, British Columbia.